There are currently more than 900,000 people on sex offender registries across the country, and that number is growing. A new report from the Huffington Post shows a patchwork of laws, from public urination to possession of child pornography to violent sexual crime, can land someone on the list for life. And some studies show that registries don't always reduce recidivism or prevent sex crimes, and laws restricting where offenders can find housing and employment can keep people on the fringes of society for life. At the same time, as more high-profile cases of sexual assault and abuse continue to make headlines, the need for protections of vulnerable communities remain. Guy Hamilton Smith is here to talk through this all. He's a legal fellow for the Sex Offense Litigation and Policy Resource Center at the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Guy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a complicated issue. It's you know, we can look at this. There's so many ways to really try to understand this. So let's start with the very beginning. Why was the sex offender registry created? What was the initial intention behind it?
Well, I mean, the initial intention behind sex offense registries was to, you know, prevent sexual harm from occurring. And they really sort of developed in the wake of high-profile offenses against children in the early and mid-1990s, difficult cases that sort of demanded a response. They were developed and then they rolled out very quickly thereafter with federal legislation in the mid-1990s, as well as state legislation. And very quickly, all 50 states adopted their own version of sex offense registries.
And how has the registry evolved over the years? Has it gotten more restrictive or has it expanded to include potential crimes that weren't included in the original iteration?
Yes. They originally sort of began more or less just as lists, lists of people who've been convicted of some crime. But the modern form of registries is that they are, they function more as kind of like a sort of shadow parole where you have a maze of restrictions and regulations that you have to, that people on these lists have to abide by or else risk returning to prison. And they have also expanded in terms of what offenses will put people on registries. States have also adopted other types of criminal offense registries, such as, you know, drug offenses, white-collar crime offenses. So they are sort of broadening both in terms of scope and complexity, as well as the number of people on them. The most recent count from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children is that there are now almost a million people who are on these public registries.
So let's talk about what kinds of crimes can actually get someone on a sex offender registry. And we know that there's a sort of patchwork of different rules and laws across the country. But what's the range here, Guy?
Well, the range is really quite broad. When we're talking about these registries, we're really talking about, you know, 50-plus different registries with 50-plus different sets of rules and 50-plus different sets of crimes that will, you know, wind people up getting on them. And so you have the obvious sort of candidates for what you would anticipate, such as rape or sexual assault or child molestation are obviously offenses that will put people on sex offense registries. But also you have, you know, offenses that are non-sexual in nature, where people get put on sex offense registries and have to comply with all these rules, such as there was a recent case out of the Southern District of New York where a federal court ordered someone to come off of registry conditions on his parole because he had been convicted of kidnapping a minor, but it was gang-related, had nothing to do with sex, but he was still ordered to register and comply with New York's sex offense registry laws, because it was a kidnapping of a minor, which the statute said you had to register for. So there's really a wide swath of different sorts of offenses and different sorts of crimes that can get people onto registries. And the essential reason for that is that, you know, dangerousness is not really a consideration for registration. It's just whether or not someone has been convicted of any kind of a crime.
Guy, what evidence do we have that sex offender registries help to reduce recidivism and actually prevent sex crimes and or protect the people who, as we mentioned earlier, who these laws were initially meant to protect, children?
Well, we all certainly care about preventing sexual harm and holding people accountable for harm that they've committed. But the evidence is that this entire field of law and policy that seeks to do that is not really reflective of the reality of sexual harm. in many ways makes sexual harm more, not less likely. The research that's been done into the effectiveness of these registries has generally concluded that they are not effective at reducing recidivism. And in fact, that recidivism rates for people convicted of sex offenses are actually much lower than is commonly believed. And that's, you know, supported by even the government's own data. In fact, research that's been done suggests that these registries actually make crime more likely by essentially making it impossible for people who have been held accountable for a criminal offense to then reintegrate into their communities and live, you know, healthy and productive lives, which is, you know, what we should want. I mean, essentially what these registries do is they misdirect our resources and attention into focusing on instances of sexual harm that aren't really reflective of the reality of sexual harm in our society. For instance, 95% of all reported sex offenses are attributable to first-time offenders, so people who are not on a registry. So to the extent that we are using these registries as a means of keeping our community safe, we're essentially missing almost all sexual violence.
I do want to ask one thing here, because I think one of the things that when we talk about the range of crimes that could leave us, that could put someone on a sex offender registry, there've been, you know, the range is often, you know, sex crimes and rape and other very serious crimes. And then it goes to something like public urination, which I'm sure most Americans would agree is, you know, the public urination thing is probably not something worthy of putting someone on a sex offender registry for life. But there is this idea that, you know, I mean, to be honest, if I or someone I knew had been the victim of a sex crime, particularly if that person was a child, I would not want to have that person reintegrated into my neighborhood, my society in a lot of ways. And I think there has to be, you know, what is the middle ground here? You know, is there a way to make sure that these behaviors are both criminalized and taken care of versus, you know, criminalizing every single person that, you know, within this wide range that we've been talking about? It just feels like, you know, it can't be a black or white situation, right?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really important that we hold people accountable, you know, for harm that they cause, you know, for crimes that they commit. And that's why we have the criminal legal system. And the criminal legal system certainly isn't perfect, obviously. But that is the system that we have for, you know, holding people accountable, and they serve their sentence. And I think that's absolutely a good thing. But on the, you know, these registries, they all come into play, you know, after someone has served their time, after someone has been held accountable. You know, the thing is that, you know, to the extent that people who are reintegrating after being held accountable for some offense succeed, then we all succeed, because that's less crime. That's more people in their communities who are having productive lives and who are raising their own families and who are contributing to our society. And this issue also speaks to how these registries have sort of become confused in the public consciousness. They're supposed to be about public safety, but the way that they're implemented and the way that they are, you know, the way that they don't really reflect evidence-based practices indicates that they're really about punishment. And if we want them to be about punishment versus public safety, you know, I think that we can decide that's what we want as a society. But I think that we ultimately have to, you know, sort of confront the reality that these laws are not effective at producing public safety, and then we can decide where to go from there.
So let's talk about one of the reasons this is even in the national conversation again is because I think in some part we're watching the Jeffrey Epstein trial unfold, and Epstein has a long history of being a sexual predator to girls, and including rape and other alleged sex acts that he's committed. And he was on a sex offender registry. And that did not seem to do, at least on the surface, did not seem to prevent him from living the life that he was living. Now, part of that is because Epstein is wealthy. And my question is, if you are not wealthy, what then?
Well, I mean, I think the Epstein case, you know, reflects a reality of our broader criminal legal system, but also when it comes to the application of sex offense registries, is that if you are someone who has resources and connections, then you have a very different experience than people without. You know, so what I hope comes out of this Epstein case is a more serious interrogation of sexual harms, because as you noted, you know, whether he was on the registry or not, like that didn't seem to have much impact on what his behavior was. But the reality is that these laws don't really have much impact on what anyone's behavior are. And so, like I said, I hope that this just leads to a deeper interrogation of sexual harm in our society.
Guy Hamilton Smith is a legal fellow for the Sex Offense Litigation and Policy Resource Center at the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Guy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.